Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Host Gene and Tim, along with team members Teresa and Linda, are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Greene counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
I am Tim Kenalty.
And I'm Jean Thomas.
And welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley.
We're here today with Barbara Huey of Land Stewardship Design in Germantown, New York. Barbara is involved in habitat restoration planning and design, as well as the reintroduction of regional native medicinals plant species. And today we're going to focus on the medicinal native plants. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, it's great to have Barbara here. I've been dying to have her here and talk to her about medicinal plants and everything else.
Yeah, and so, Barbara, one of the first things we like to ask our podcast guests is to tell us a bit about their background and what led you to native plant restoration and your interest especially in native medicinal plants.
Okay, well, thank you. To begin with, I guess I would point out that I was really lucky as a little kid. My parents, my father in particular, who grew up in a subsistence lifestyle in a very rural setting in the Ozark Mountains, knew a great deal about nature. And my mother was a registered nurse. So she brought her medical training and expertise to our daily lives. And she knew a great deal about it. She was a World War II front lines nurse, and she ran whole floors in big medical centers in the metropolitan area. But she was happy to put aloe vera on your burn if you got too close to the stove. So between the two of them, I had a combination of interests that was fostered. We also had 100 acres of woodlands in the Taconic Hills growing up where we spent every weekend. So we were hiking and identifying birds and plants and bugs and salamanders. And I think that experience, more than anything, gave me kind of a pattern recognition for looking at what wild landscapes were like and recognizing how they interacted and how they smelled and how they felt and what it was like to be in the midst of that intact community. So all of those things contributed to my eventually going to Cornell and studying plant and soil science and being involved in a lot of agriculture, and then horticulture. So all of those many things contributed to my having an interest in going to Cornell. I studied plant and soil science and ecology and biology there, and that launched me into work with horticulture and agriculture both, but also some land use planning. Then I started looking around the landscapes where I was working and realizing that the wild sections of those landscapes were thriving, where a lot of our horticultural operations and agricultural operations were either starving for water or nutrients, and we were having to manipulate them a great deal. And then the wild edges were thriving and full of life, and birds and butterflies and animals. And I thought, what am I doing wrong here? You know, and I started reconsidering my priorities. Then the medicinal plants started resonating for me through a number of different pathways, but I ended up studying with Rosemary Gladstar at the Sage Mountain Herbal Studies School in Vermont. Rosemary has 700 acres of carefully stewarded woodlot and meadow and swampland and fens, and she was the founding president of an organization called United Plant Savers. United Plant Savers is a national group that fosters the care and success of native medicinal plants all across the country. So spending whole, you know, days at a time at Sage Mountain, we would walk and walk and walk and look at what was there and look at what she was reintroducing or fostering or making room for. And it was all those pieces interacting in a matrix that I got bit by the bug in a serious way, and I've been working on that premise of the importance of all of those things being present in the landscape.
That is so great. I love hearing people's backgrounds, and I always learn about people. I've known you for quite a while, Barbara, yeah. And I always learn new things about people on the podcast. That's why we invite people on, so we can learn new things and ask some questions we're embarrassed to ask because we've known them a long time. No, that's really wonderful. So we always kind of start with definitions, and I know I've done talks, and I've heard lots and lots of webinars of people defining what exactly a native plant is, and not just kind of like pre-colonial, but like what's your definition in terms of geography and ecotype? And so when you talk to clients, what's your definition of a native plant?
That's a really important, good question that's hard to answer, because sometimes we think about it strictly as pre-colonial, but really our knowledge of that is fairly limited. It has to do with experience. It has to do with that sensation of intact and thriving. But I also rely much more current and modern on the USDA Plant ID website. It's something I have bookmarked. I wrote down the exact address for it, so I can share that at the end. But
well, yeah, we can put it in our show notes so people can go and reference it. Definitely.
It's an excellent reference. You do have to know the Latin name. So you've got to do a little homework perhaps on that note, but then they will give you down to the county level what should be present and where it's found all over the country. Many of what we consider native plants will be also native in the Great Lakes region, because a lot of the way that species exist and distribute themselves have to do with water and air patterns. It's not just, you know, what's on the map, the paper map. So it's good to keep an open mind about these things. And things are changing. Things are migrating north with climate change. There's a lot of things that we wouldn't have risked trying to grow before that are now doing rather well. But in addition to that, I would also add that it's not only about is it present in Columbia or Greene County, but go a little deeper and say where. So is it found in a cool ravine? Is it found in a fen, a wetland? Is it an upland plant? One of the plants we were going to talk about today was jewelweed, for example, as a wonderful first aid plant. And it likes wet soil. It'll tolerate a lot of shade. Many of us know this plant. The flowers are yellow or orange. The stem is very hollow and delicate. You macerate it between the palms of your hands and put it on poison ivy or any kind of skin irritation, and it's right there for you. It's a wonderful plant, and perhaps some people think it a weed because it's a little aggressive, but it's something we can't do without, in my opinion. It's just fantastic.
Well, and I love that you're talking about jewelweed and where it's native, because weirdly, I never had it in my garden, and I've gardened in my 13 acres for 30 years, and all of a sudden, I had jewelweed all throughout my perennial garden last year, and I think it's because it was so wet, and somehow the seeds got there, because it's an annual. So it was native this year, but it wasn't native any other years in my garden.
Well, part of its name, because I know a whole bunch of nonsense, is touch me not. They spit their seeds.
Right.
It kept spitting.
I guess so.
Yes, and another really fun thing about jewelweed is that, which is really close relative of impatiens, it's an impatiens. We know that from horticulture, but jewelweed, if you take a sprig and put it under water, it turns silver, bright metallic silver. Try it.
Very cool.
And so it's a really fun plant to work with little kids with, because they are so delighted by that. And it looks as though it's literally made of sparkling, brilliant silver.
So we're talking about jewelweed, and not to go too far down the rabbit hole, but I'm going to ask you another jewelweed question, which is, so I'm in my home garden. I think, oh, that sounds really good, jewelweed, because I have poison ivy and blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
Can I plant jewelweed, though? Or is jewelweed something that just kind of appears? There's all kinds of germination issues with it. Like, it's not like a Monarda that I can go buy a Monarda and plant it and it comes up every year. It just appears when it wants to, right? When the conditions are right.
Yeah, but I do find that it's persistent where I find it. Oh. I find it again and again and again. And as you say, when those pods are ripe and you burst them, you can scatter that seed and it will choose for itself if it's the right moment to germinate.
Huh.
So a lot of reintroduction has to do with patience and let things take their own time.
Oh, so something I don't have, I guess. Oh, that's bad for us.
Yeah, that's a problem, right?
Okay, so I assume you're going to tell us about all of these plants we can find in the woods and fields to be medicinal. Another definitional question. Are we talking about plants that you ingest or more about the ones that you would apply externally to your skin? Because I kind of worry about having a medicinal plant that you go chew on to make you feel better about something.
Right. And that's maybe a perfect time to say, don't neglect visits to your doctor. don't rely on my recommendations for using plants. If you've got a persistent health issue or skin issue, you've got to talk to your doctor and an experienced herbalist about using things. And so we're kind of talking today mostly about first aid. But it's always important to know that anything that's persistent or really troublesome, you need to see a professional.
So we can't go off the grid is what you're saying.
No, not entirely. We don't have that kind of experience. And dosage matters with all things. But if we're judicious about it and we use things in small amounts and as a first aid remedy, then they're time tested. This was the medicine of the people for thousands and thousands of years.
Well, that was my question. It's like there must be a lot of knowledge from indigenous people who use these herbs and plants for years and years and years, right?
Certainly. And one of the plants we were going to talk about today was yarrow.
Let's talk about yarrow.
And yarrow is an upland, meadow, full-sun, perennial plant that the native people used extensively. One of the ways they used it was for arthritis. Its Latin name is Achillea. It's named after the famous warrior Achilles, and it was used to staunch bleeding. So again, you're macerating it between your hands and making a poultice to staunch bleeding. Yarrow has also been used by native peoples and through to our time for toothache. It's a really wonderful medicinal plant that's quite safe and easy to grow and beautiful, just beautiful year-round.
And as far as arthritis goes, are you talking about ingesting it or are you talking about rubbing it on an area that...
I think in that case, we would be talking about a tea.
Ah, okay.
A tea. Okay. So a lot of these plants are both used topically and internally.
Okay, now you mentioned a tea and millions and millions of the herbs are used as teas. Yarrow comes in all kinds of hybrids and different colors and things now in the markets. Are all yarrows the same, or do you have to stick to the wild ones?
Oh, that's an excellent, excellent question, because it's hard to know. There's not enough scientific research on some of these things, but we do know that a lot of the medicinal properties are called secondary properties. The plant doesn't need these elements to grow. It's like a gift to us and to other creatures that it maintains this ability to heal. And those qualities and characteristics can be bred out through seeking a brighter orange bloom or a stouter stature. Those things can be changed in ways that we don't really have a way of knowing very deeply. So it's recommended that you always use the species, the original species. So Achillea millefolium is the species that is used medicinally.
So the one we find from the field is probably going to be more useful than the pretty striped polka-dotted one that we bought at the market.
I would tend in that direction, yeah.
I mean, that's true for pollinators too, right? It's like it seems like when this breeding and the hybridization happens for a lot of these, they are breeding things out, maybe even unintentionally, that they're not realizing, right?
I agree, yeah. I think that's a real possibility. So always going for the original hardy species is a good idea.
So you have bee balm on your list, which is like one of my favorite perennials. And I know people make tea. I love the smell of it. Some people just find it to be offensive. I love the smell, but it's medicinal as well as making tea. What can I go out? Can I like roll around in my bee-bomb and feel better? Or how's it work?
I guarantee you'll feel much better.
I know I will feel better, right? As long as I'm
can
not...
I come too?
No, not at all. Not at all. But what, I mean, but, and I know it's really native to Columbia County, bee-bomb, because I see it, you know, out there when nobody's planted it.
Yeah. Monarda fistulosa bee-bomb, which is the lavender blooming, is really quite common in this area. All the way to the Delaware Water Gap, I've seen it in huge numbers. I planted about 3/4 acre of meadow at a particular time that favored the bee balm. I have essentially 3/4 acre of bee balm. And one of the things that it's touted at, well, first of all, I should say the name bee balm, which you asked me about earlier, was useful for bee stings.
Right,
and it's
right.
In fact, it's used to reduce swelling. As a poultice, it's very effective for stings and things like that. But it's also known, and the native peoples used it in this way too, it's used for deep respiratory troubles as a tea, and especially in the event that there's a low-grade fever. So it's thought to draw the heat out of the deep systems. And when COVID was raging, my friend Claudia Keel, who runs the Arborvitae School of Herbalism now in New Paltz, used to be in New York City, brought her students to my meadow, and they gathered armloads of Monarda to take home because they were treating people with COVID. It's quite a useful plant and an incredible pollinator
plant. And there's no downside. I mean, like, there's, we talked about risk a little bit. There's no risk in making a bee balm tea for yourself no matter what, right? Even if you're not feeling ill.
Right. When using medicinal plants, you always want to have a feeling of respect and gratitude, because one of the things the native peoples teach us is don't be greedy and always be thankful, and that the medicine is actually more useful used in that spirit, which is a little different level of communication with those plants and interaction with those plants. But even with anything, you don't need to drink gallons of it. More is not better. You want to have a cup that you sip during the course of the day. You might have a little later on. You monitor how you're feeling. Are you feeling better? You don't need as much. So anything used to excess, not a great idea.
I'm detecting a theme here. Patience and moderation.
It's hard. Exactly. It's hard for us. But
yeah.
I mean, it's a great rule.
Yeah, it's a nice thought.
It's good you've come here to influence us positively.
Well, I should take my own advice sometimes too.
But you know, it's funny because we just talked about breeding, and I just watched a webinar last night that I thought was so interesting because they were talking about Monarda fistulosa, and they were talking about a cultivar of that, I guess a cultivar called Claire Grace, which is a kind of brighter color. And I thought when it came out, oh, I have to have this. And guess what? It didn't do well in my garden. And the reason is because they found the natural selection of it in Mississippi. So it wasn't hardy really around here. So like you have to really be careful when you're getting those cultivars, even if they're maybe a little bit more beautiful. They may not really be native,
right,
quotes around it, to
right
where we are. Right?
Well, and Monarda didymo, the bright red version of bee balm, which I had in abundance when I lived in upstate, you know, west and north of here, is not that common here. It's the flavor ingredient for Earl Grey tea. So it's a little stronger, and it's bright red. It's very hummingbird and moth attractive, but it's not quite as happy here as the lavender fistulosa.
And it has it likes a little damper, I think, right? I mean, fistulosa seems like it's so tough it can just...
Well, and I also found the red version didymo in the woods,
which
I've never found purple fistulosa in the shade.
In the shade, no.
No.
No. All right, Monarda is a mint. And can we take as a rule of thumb, and I like generalizations, that most mints are safe to make teas? I mean, I'll experiment, peppermint.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I don't know that I'd go out and make a tea out of mountain mint. I mean, that's a mint, right? And it's lovely smelling, and the deer don't eat it, and it's a good pollinator plant, but I don't know that I'd be drinking it either.
The mint family is huge, okay. And so I wouldn't put that in your generalization.
So be respectful, be patient, and don't generalize. Our three rules now coming out.
And don't forget moderation.
Moderation too. I'm kind of starting to not like all this.
Yeah.
No, here's one that I always knew was somewhat helpful, and I can't remember even why, is plantain, which you find in your yard, right? That's on your list.
That's my lawn.
Yeah.
Your whole lawn is plantain. Lawn.
You've got a whole herbal medicinal lawn then, mm-hmm. right?
The neighbors come rolling
in. What do we do with plantain? What's the use for plantain?
Oh, you know, it's... I would say it may be the plant I use the most of all of them. It's a real solid plant ally for me. And it's not native. It's an introduced, naturalized plant. The indigenous peoples of North America used to call it white man's footsteps.
Because that is great. I like that a lot.
It went everywhere the Europeans went. Right. There was the plantain right behind them. And whether it came on the tires of their wagons or the soles of their boots, or I'm not sure all of the above, but it is a naturalized plant all across the country. It's a drawing salve principally. It's used to take the venom out of a bite. It'll extract the stinger of a bee sting. It will take a splinter out. Even if the skin is grown over it, if you put a poultice of plantain on there with a Band-Aid, check it in a couple of hours, and it's ready to come out.
Oh, that's so cool.
I want to go get a splinter.
So you've used the word poultice a couple times. When you say poultice, you mean you just chop it up?
Poultice is a very important way to use medicinal plants. You can chop it up. You can chew it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people don't want you to chew it up and put it on their hand, but it will work beautifully.
I can't imagine.
Then you ask them to do it themselves, and the effect will be just as good. Yeah, plantain is a beautiful plant. It's very soothing. It has a mucilaginous factor to it, so it's very soothing and healing and cooling. So any kind of bite or invasive thing, I've seen it take out a piece of glass.
Huh.
That somebody got caught under
their
skin.
So if I get stung by yellow jackets, it's something that I would use in addition to jewel weed, yes?
Yeah, I'd use the plantain first.
Okay, I have plenty of plantain too, so maybe we could be selling these, Gene. What do you think, selling plantain?
It'd be a tough sell once people recognized it.
I assume it's better to go out and get the fresh plantain than buying powdered plantain on Amazon or something like that. Is that a true statement?
That's a true statement.
Okay.
The leaf is a bit thick, and so there's a lot of water in it. It doesn't dry well. In fact, I've never heard of it used, dried, and reactivated. People do make oil of the plantain, but you've got to let it dry a little bit, and then you've got to skim the water that floats in the oils. And plantain used fresh, picked, say thank you, chew it or chop it up, and use it right away.
There's an overlap between culinary and medicinal. Mm. For instance, elderberries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, don't they have all sorts of herbal uses?
Yes. Elderberry has really gained in popularity and is used as an immune system, an overall strengthening immune system enhancement. It's a remarkable plant. The native peoples used it. They thought it was very similarly to the way we're using it today, for colds and coughs and syrups. They mixed it with honey. I do a syrup with honey and lemon. Elderberry is, in order to be palatable, has to be cooked a bit. So I just put all that in a double boiler and let it cook down like you would a jam. And the syrup is amazing. If you feel a little something coming on, a little cold symptoms, then you just start taking the syrup, but teaspoon at a time and use it that way. It also makes delicious jam, back to that idea, and it can be stored that way in a thicker, small jar portions. Elderberry is a native shrub that's beautiful. It likes somewhat wet soil. You'll find it sort of on the edges of streams or in depressions on roadsides. There's really handsome big bushes at the store site for the Columbia Land Conservancy. Magnificent, probably 50-year-old bushes. They're enormous. The other use for elderberry that I love is collecting the flowers. You steep those in oil. That's another good thing to make with olive oil. And you steep them in a jar completely covered in the oil for 2 or 3 weeks. And then that makes an incredible skin healing oil that can be used in salves mixed with beeswax or other ingredients that you might like to use. Elderberry is a very important plant. And it flowers a little later than many of our other trees and shrubs. So it's extremely important for pollinators.
And an elderflower, that's something I hear a lot when, I don't know, people are British Bake Off and things like that. A lot of people are using elderflower as an ingredient to baking, right?
Oh, I hadn't known that.
Yeah.
Flower, F-L-O-U-R, flower?
No, elderflower like the flower. It's
a spice or an herb or something.
Flavor, yeah. Okay. I mean, so obviously a lot of these have multiple food and flavoring and medicinal uses. And you talk about not just gathering them and having awareness, but also reintroducing them into the landscape, right? I mean, not just for pollinators, but for their uses. I mean, for
Correct.
Their medicinal uses, right? How do you do that? And how do you, if you have clients that you're doing some landscaping for, how do you even approach that?
I learned something from a teacher of mine years ago. His name was Dennis Martinez. And he said that he was really working hard to have traditional environmental knowledge, native indigenous people's knowledge, become part of big land use planning technologies combined with Western science. And he said that a lot of this work is to do with our becoming native to where we are. So when we start to see the source of our food and medicine and sustenance right around us all the time, we step differently on the landscape and we treat it differently. And so it becomes a symbiotic relationship. So our job is to correct some of the mistakes that we have obviously made in eliminating or over-harvesting a lot of this, making it scarce or non-existent in the landscape, and saying, no, we're going to be productive, positive influences on where we live. And that pollinator habitat has become colloquialized, and a lot of people's awareness has increased tremendously with just that goal in mind. There's so many ways to approach this work. Some people do it because they're birders. Some people do it because they're pollinator aware. Some people do it because they're herbalists. We just have to do it because all of those things are affected by this. And I think when people have a sense that they can have that positive influence, then they dive in. Because it's in our bones that we depend on the environment. It's only recently that we've gotten away from the idea, you know, that food comes from California or
chili. Right.
You name it. It was always, you know, for many tens of thousands of years, we had to take care of it in order to survive. So that love and appreciation and involvement and wisdom was just common sense, really. And so I think that if you tap into that, people know that that's right. And so they're excited by it.
Okay, so we're talking about love. You've answered a couple questions about the medicinal things that we love. What would be your favorite, your priorities of these medicinal plants, the top of your list to like introduce everywhere that are maybe underestimated?
So unfair to ask.
No,
for
it's
favorites.
Not. She has favorites.
You've talked about some favorites probably already.
Are we
missing some favorites that you haven't mentioned so far?
There are some things that I just can't live without. Some of them are native, some of them are introduced. I make oils from St. John's wort every single year. I make comfrey oil every single year. I'm really fortunate in that I have beautiful basswood trees on my property that bloom also at a really strategic time for pollinators, big pollinator plant. But the flowers are an anti-anxiety medicine, like a calming, very gentle calming medicine, and they are wonderful tea. I'm also growing ginseng on our property. It took 3 years for it to germinate. Talk about patience.
Yeah, really, yeah.
But the root crops that used to be so common here, many of those are real favorites of mine. So ginseng, golden seal, black cohosh, bloodroot. Those are all plants that were over-harvested. And so now they're scarce. A root crop like that, you take the whole plant, it's gone. It's not like harvesting a flower. A couple of people over the years have said to me, where's all the ginseng? I said, you harvested it. And so Bob Beavis, who was such an important teacher, who we've just recently lost, very sadly, taught a lot of people how to grow ginseng. It belongs in the landscape. It's a great teacher because it won't thrive without its community of other plants. It needs to have golden seal nearby. The influence that a lot of these plants have on the soil environment is not much discussed, but extremely important. And there's always microbes and fungi and things that associate with these plant roots that need the plants just like the plants need the fungi and the microorganisms. You can smell a healthy woodland environment because all those things are present. That rich, mushroomy smell means that things are working well. And so a lot of my favorites are plants that I know from the woodland environment, which was a lot of our medicines because this was a wooded environment.
Yeah. Can we ask you one last question then? And I think I know where you're going to go with this. And I love talking kind of philosophically about us not being separate from the land, being actually part of it, not really thinking of us as separate from nature. And I've been hearing that a lot from people. And I think that's maybe where people are getting really energized about thinking about ecosystems and native plants. But tell us, and we ask a lot of people this, kind of what are you hopeful for in terms of what you're doing and what you're gardening and what you're seeing out there? Tell us something hopeful.
I'm really hopeful. I think that you're doing this work and helping people get a language for this is really important and really indicative of the time is nigh. There's so much more awareness now than there was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when talking about these things was sort of fringy. Mm-hmm. And not, it's really not now. I mean, it never should have been, but it really isn't. And the ambassadors like the monarch butterfly that have gotten people aware that butterflies like honeybees are generalists, but their caterpillars are specialists. And so people now know what a milkweed plant looks like. And it's in the New York Times. And there's so much more awareness and discussion about it. There's the Xerces Society that people, if you're not familiar with them, it's a wonderful place to study and learn about from the ground up. What does it take? What are the complexities? But what's familiar within that matrix of complexities that we can help to foster and encourage? United Plant Savers, I mentioned earlier, another incredible resource. Doug Tallamy, who has done more than anybody in recent days to help people feel empowered and teach us about entomology and plants. And he's the movie now, what's the Homegrown National Park? Mm-hmm. And a number of the communities around here are showing that movie and teaching their residents, you know, less lawn, more wildness, don't rake. Wait until things emerge in the spring. One really cool thing that's happened recently is Bard College amassed, I think it was like $50,000 to do a meadow project right on 9G.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on the property that they acquired when they bought Montgomery Place, so that everybody going up down that road is going to see a healthy meadow. And so getting familiar with what's healthy, the Hawthorne Valley Farmscape Ecology Program that many of people are familiar with, they take people out on walks and it's very well attended. I just think that the partnerships like that are now extended to the Natural Resource Conservation Service is now funding projects on private lands to handle invasive species management. They're called interruptive species, because they limit biodiversity. It's pretty pervasive, this awareness, and I think that's something to feel very hopeful about.
That makes me hopeful, and I've been seeing the same, especially just in the last couple of years. So thank you. Thank you for being here, really. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you for having me. And, delightful.
And I hope you'll come back and talk about other things like this. We'd love to have you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for what you're doing.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Linnell and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.